Chapter 14. Should say he was, let me see, how old are you, about? ? I told him between 8 and 9. That's just his age, ? He said. He was 8 years and 6 months old when they broke his first rib, 8 years and 8 months old when they broke his second, and did for him. ? I could not disguise from myself, or from the waiter, that this was an uncomfortable coincidence, and inquired how it was done. His answer was not cheering to my spirits, for it consisted of two dismal words, with whopping. ? The blowing of the coach horn in the yard was a seasonable diversion, which made me get up and hesitatingly inquire, in the mingled pride and diffidence of having a purse which I took out of my pocket, if there were anything to pay. There's a sheet of letter paper, ? He returned. Did you ever buy a sheet of letter paper? ? I could not remember that I ever had. It's dear, ? He said, on account of the duty. 3 pence. That's the way we're taxed in this country. There's nothing else, except the waiter. Never mind the ink. I lose by that. ? What should you, what should I, how much ought I to, what would it be right to pay the waiter, if you please? ? I stammered, blushing. If I hadn't a family, and that family hadn't the cowpock, ? Said the waiter, I wouldn't take a sixpence. If I didn't support a aged parent, and a lovely sister, ? Here the waiter was greatly agitated, I wouldn't take a farthing. If I had a good place, and was treated well here, I should beg acceptance of a trifle, instead of taking of it. But I live on broken wittles, and I sleep on the coals here. The waiter burst into tears. I was very much concerned for his misfortunes, and felt that any recognition short of 9 pence would be mere brutality and hardness of heart. Therefore I gave him one of my 3 bright shillings, which he received with much humility and veneration, and spun up with his thumb, directly afterwards, to try the goodness of. It was a little disconcerting to me, to find, when I was being helped up behind the coach, that I was supposed to have eaten all the dinner without any assistance. I discovered this, from overhearing the lady in the bow window say to the guard, "Take care of that child, George, or he'll burst." ? And from observing that the women servants who were about the place came out to look and giggle at me as a young phenomenon. My unfortunate friend the waiter, who had quite recovered his spirits, did not appear to be disturbed by this, but joined in the general admiration without being at all confused. If I had any doubt of him, I suppose this half awakened it. But I am inclined to believe that with the simple confidence of a child, and the natural reliance of a child upon superior years, qualities I am very sorry any children should prematurely change for worldly wisdom, I had no serious mistrust of him on the whole, even then. I felt it rather hard, I must own, to be made, without deserving it, the subject of jokes between the coachman and guard, as to the coach drawing heavy behind, on account of my sitting there, and as to the greater expediency of my traveling by wagon. The story of my supposed appetite getting wind among the outside passengers, they were merry upon it likewise, and asked me, whether I was going to be paid for, at school, as 2 brothers or 3, and whether I was contracted for, or went upon the regular terms, with other pleasant questions. But the worst of it was, that I knew I should be ashamed to eat anything, when an opportunity offered, and that, after a rather light dinner, I should remain hungry all night, for I had left my cakes behind, at the hotel, in my hurry. My apprehensions were realized. When we stopped for supper I couldn't muster courage to take any, though I should have liked it very much, but sat by the fire and said I didn't want anything. This did not save me from more jokes either, for a husky-voiced gentleman with a rough face, who had been eating out of a sandwich box nearly all the way, except when he had been drinking out of a bottle, said I was like a boa constrictor who took enough at one meal, to last him a long time, after which, he actually brought a rash out upon himself with boiled beef. We had started from Yarmouth at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were due in London about 8 next morning. It was midsummer weather, and the evening was very pleasant. When we passed through a village, I pictured to myself what the insides of the houses were like, and what the inhabitants were about. And when boys came running after us, and got up behind and swung there for a little way, I wondered whether their fathers were alive, and whether they were happy at home. I had plenty to think of, therefore, besides my mind running continually on the kind of place I was going to, which was an awful speculation. Sometimes, I remember, I resigned myself to thoughts of home and Peggotty, and to endeavoring, in a confused blind way, to recall how I had felt, and what sort of boy I used to be, before I bit Mr. Murdstone. Which I couldn't satisfy myself about by any means, I seemed to have bitten him in such a remote antiquity. The night was not so pleasant as the evening, for it got chilly, and being put between two gentlemen, the rough-faced one, and another, to prevent my tumbling off the coach, I was nearly smothered by their falling asleep, and completely blocking me up. They squeezed me so hard sometimes, that I could not help crying out, "Oh, if you please," apostrophe, which they didn't like at all, because it woke them. Opposite me was an elderly lady in a great fur cloak, who looked in the dark more like a haystack than a lady. She was wrapped up to such a degree. This lady had a basket with her, and she hadn't known what to do with it for a long time, until she found that on account of my legs being short, it could go underneath me. It cramped and hurt me so, that it made me perfectly miserable. But if I moved in the least, and made a glass that was in the basket rattle against something else, as it was sure to do, she gave me the cruelest poke with her foot, and said, "Come, don't you fidget. Your bones are young enough, I'm sure." Apostrophe, apostrophe, at last the sun rose, and then my companion seemed to sleep easier. The difficulties under which they had labored all night, and which had found utterance in the most terrific gasps and snorts, are not to be conceived. As the sun got higher, their sleep became lighter, and so they gradually one by one awoke. I recollect being very much surprised by the feint everybody made, then, of not having been to sleep at all, and by the uncommon indignation with which everyone repelled the charge. I labor under the same kind of astonishment to this day, having invariably observed that of all human weaknesses, the one to which our common nature is the least disposed to confess, I cannot imagine why, is the weakness of having gone to sleep in a coach. What an amazing place London was to me, when I saw it in the distance, and how I believed all the adventures of all my favorite heroes to be constantly enacting and reenacting there, and how I vaguely made it out in my own mind to be fuller of wonders and wickedness than all the cities of the earth, I need not stop here to relate. We approached it by degrees, and got, in due time, to the inn in the Whitechapel district, for which we were bound. I forget whether it was the Blue Bull, or the Blue Boar, but I know it was the blue something, and that its likeness was painted upon the back of the coach. The guard's eye lighted on me as he was getting down, and he said at the booking office door, "Is there anybody here for a youngster booked in the name of Murdstone, from Blunderstone, Suffolk, to be left till called for?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, nobody answered. "Try Copperfield, if you please, sir," apostrophe said I, looking helplessly down. "Is there anybody here for a youngster, booked in the name of Murdstone, from Blunderstone, Suffolk, but owning to the name of Copperfield, to be left till called for?" Apostrophe, apostrophe said the guard. "Come. Is there anybody?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, no. There was nobody. I looked anxiously around, but the inquiry made no impression on any of the bystanders, if I except a man in gaiters, with one eye, who suggested that they had better put a brass collar round my neck, and tie me up in the stable. A ladder was brought, and I got down after the lady, who was like a haystack, not daring to stir, until her basket was removed. The coach was clear of passengers by that time. The luggage was very soon cleared out. The horses had been taken out before the luggage, and now the coach itself was wheeled and backed off by some hostlers out of the way. Still, nobody appeared to claim the moldy youngster from Blunderstone, Suffolk. More solitary than Robinson Crusoe, who had nobody to look at him and see that he was solitary, I went into the booking office and, by invitation of the clerk on duty, passed behind the counter and sat down on the scale at which they weighed the luggage. Here, as I sat looking at the parcels, packages, and books, and inhaling the smell of stables ever since associated with that morning, a procession of most tremendous considerations began to march through my mind. Supposing nobody should ever fetch me, how long would they consent to keep me there? Would they keep me long enough to spend 7 shillings? Should I sleep at night in one of those wooden bins, with the other luggage, and wash myself at the pump in the yard in the morning? Or should I be turned out every night, and expected to come again, to be left till called for, when the office opened next day? Supposing there was no mistake in the case, and Mr. Murdstone had devised this plan to get rid of me, what should I do? If they allowed me to remain there until my 7 shillings were spent, I couldn't hope to remain there when I began to starve. That would obviously be inconvenient and unpleasant to the customers, besides entailing on the Blue whatever it was, the risk of funeral expenses. If I started off at once and tried to walk back home, how could I ever find my way? How could I ever hope to walk so far? How could I make sure of anyone but Peggotty, even if I got back? If I found out the nearest proper authorities, and offered myself to go for a soldier or a sailor, I was such a little fellow that it was most likely they wouldn't take me in. These thoughts, and 100 other such thoughts, turned me burning hot, and made me giddy with apprehension and dismay. I was in the height of my fever, when a man entered and whispered to the clerk, who presently slanted me off the scale, and pushed me over to him, as if I were weighed, bought, delivered, and paid for. As I went out of the office, hand in hand with this new acquaintance, I stole a look at him. He was a gaunt, sallow young man, with hollow cheeks, and a chin almost as black as Mr. Murdstone's. But there the likeness ended, for his whiskers were shaved off, and his hair, instead of being glossy, was rusty and dry. He was dressed in a suit of black clothes which were rather rusty and dry too, and rather short in the sleeves and legs, and he had a white neckerchief on that was not over clean. I did not, and do not, suppose that this neckerchief was all the linen he wore, but it was all he showed or gave any hint of. "You're the new boy?" he said. "Yes, sir," I said. I supposed I was. I didn't know. "I'm one of the masters at Salem House," he said. I made him a bow and felt very much overawed. I was so ashamed to allude to a commonplace thing like my box, to a scholar and a master at Salem House, that we had gone some little distance from the yard, before I had the hardihood to mention it. We turned back, on my humbly insinuating that it might be useful to me hereafter, and he told the clerk that the carrier had instructions to call for it at noon. "If you please, sir," I said, when we had accomplished about the same distance as before, "is it far?" "It's down by Blackheath," he said. "Is that far, sir?" I diffidently asked. "It's a good step," he said. "We shall go by the stagecoach. It's about 6 miles." I was so faint and tired that the idea of holding out for 6 miles more was too much for me. I took heart to tell him that I had had nothing all night, and that if he would allow me to buy something to eat, I should be very much obliged to him. He appeared surprised at this. I see him stop and look at me now, and after considering for a few moments, said he wanted to call on an old person who lived not far off, and that the best way would be for me to buy some bread, or whatever I liked best that was wholesome, and make my breakfast at her house, where we could get some milk. Accordingly, we looked in at a baker's window, and after I had made a series of proposals, to buy everything that was bilious in the shop, and he had rejected them one by one, we decided in favor of a nice little loaf of brown bread, which cost me 3 pence. Then, at a grocer's shop, we bought an egg and a slice of streaky bacon, which still left what I thought a good deal of change, out of the second of the bright shillings, and made me consider London a very cheap place. These provisions laid in, we went on through a great noise and uproar that confused my weary head beyond description, and over a bridge which, no doubt, was London Bridge.
Indeed, I think he told me so, but I was half asleep, until we came to the poor person's house, which was a part of some almshouses,
as I knew by their look, and by an inscription on a stone over the gate which said they were established for 25 poor women. The master at Salem House lifted the latch of one of a number of little black doors that were all alike, and had each a little diamond-paned window on one side, and another little diamond-paned window above, and we went into the little house of one of these poor old women, who was blowing a fire to make a little saucepan boil. On seeing the master enter, the old woman stopped with the bellows on her knee, and said something that I thought sounded like my Charlie. But on seeing me come into, she got up, and rubbing her hands made a confused sort of half-curtsy. "Can you cook this young gentleman's breakfast for him, if you please?" said the master at Salem House. "Can I?" said the old woman. "Yes, can I, sure. How's Mrs. Fibbitson today?" said the master, looking at another old woman in a large chair by the fire, who was such a bundle of clothes, that I feel grateful to this hour for not having sat upon her by mistake. "Ah, she's poorly," said the first old woman. "It's one of her bad days. If the fire was to go out, through any accident, I verily believe she'd go out too, and never come to life again." As they looked at her, I looked at her also. Although it was a warm day, she seemed to think of nothing but the fire. I fancied she was jealous even of the saucepan on it, and I have reason to know that she took its impressment into the service of boiling my egg and broiling my bacon, in dudgeon, for I saw her, with my own discomfited eyes, shake her fist at me once, when those culinary operations were going on, and no one else was looking. The sun streamed in at the little window, but she sat with her own back, and the back of the large chair towards it, screening the fire, as if she were sedulously keeping it warm, instead of it keeping her warm, and watching it in a most distrustful manner. The completion of the preparations for my breakfast, by relieving the fire, gave her such extreme joy, that she laughed aloud and a very Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.